Coaching Inside the Box,
a youth soccer coaching podcast.
A Brit,
a Brazilian,
and an American
discuss culture and environment
and the impact it has on youth development.
Can you coach inside the box?
Hello and welcome back to another riveting, surely to be riveting episode of Coaching Inside the Box with Andy, Andrew, and Philippe. This one is set to be our best one yet. And Philippe, why is that probably the case?
Because Andy has no... Oh, wait a minute.
Wait. Andy had no notes, but then he brought out two pieces of paper. So we shall see
how that's it probably, plays out. That's probably just the jokes. And then after
that's just
that,
the jokes. We'll yeah, maybe it's jokes.
There's only one joke today.
There's only one joke. Oh, this is... Yeah. You guys are in for a treat.
But it's two pages.
Everybody's cheering on the other end today.
But the one... Keep your hands on the driving. Pages. The one joke is two pages.
One joke is two pages. Welcome back. Guys, it's March. Spring season is here. I've had outdoor games in Kansas City in actually really nice weather. Philippe, how are your teams kicking off? Are you
good? Very
happy
good.
To be back outside playing soccer again?
Yeah, I mean... It's been good. The beginning of the season has been good. Boys are playing good. You know, we don't stop over the winter, and I think that helps because they go out there in the spring flying.
Well, this might have to be a two-man show, the way Philippe's voice sounds. He's been coaching too much on the weekends.
Yeah, and during the week, too. Too many practices and then the weekend games and all that. Just the voice goes to hell. Eventually.
I got to be honest, I like it when I can't hear Philippe.
I remember as a player liking it on Andy's 12th game of a Saturday, thinking, oh, I won't hear his voice at all today.
Yeah, I used to scream until I lost my voice.
Well, by the last game yesterday, I was literally to the outside back on the other side. I would look, then I would think, should I yell? And I'm like, I'm going to yell as hard as I can. He's not going to listen to a word. So I would just turn, tell one of the boys on the bench, can you yell this for me?
Can you yell this for me?
I used to do the same. You know, I tell the story about the Winter Magic Tournament, and I used to schedule this tournament, a great tournament. Teams from, you know, all over the states here and around Kansas used to bring, you know, come in, and it was knock down, drag out. And I was coaching eight teams, and every team, you know, was in the final. But I'd set the final up so that, in the two-field facility that we used for the tournament, my teams would be on both fields at the same time for the last four slots of the weekend for the finals. So, you know, team one and two would be at, you know, 4 o'clock, and three and four would be at 5 o'clock, and, you know, et cetera. And so I had this situation where all eight teams were in the final, and all eight teams ended up winning. I had no voice left. So what I did is, you know, I would go from field to field depending on who needed me most. You know, if my team was up by three goals, I'd stay on the other field, you know, and help the team that needed me. But I would actually tell, you know, my assistant coach, like Dean Brandel on your team,
yeah.
I would tell Dean, you need to tell this. And I'd whisper it in his ear, because all I could do was whisper at that point in time. And then I would walk along the bench, you know, and talk to the next shift. That was because, you know, people were in and out all the time in indoor, yeah. 2 minute shifts, you know, and I would tell everybody in the next shift, you know, what they should be focusing on. But I'd have to literally, you know, like almost nibble their earlobe with all the noise going on. And I had no volume left at all.
No.
It was the hoarsest. Is that a word? Horsest?
I think it's horsiest.
It was the horsiest.
Pretty good. Who knew Andy
there.
Had that talent?
Yeah. Have some experience
that I've ever been. Anyway, you know, this joke.
Wait, before we get to the joke, I want to continue with a little banter about soccer. Andy, you've been watching the women. Is it the Gold Cup? What's the event? I have not
Gold
watched.
Cup, yeah.
Gold Cup.
Yeah.
And you specifically texted last night saying that you were quite impressed with two of the attackers for Mexico.
Oh, yeah. Their left and right wingers, you know, had some wonderful moves, you know, like, you know, pre-worked upon moves that worked and worked and worked in the one-on-one. I mean, the other day when they beat the U.S., their second goal was scored by their left winger. And last night, I had the names down, but now they've escaped me. Because
one started with an O and one started with a P, if my memory serves.
It's Ove or something is one of them. And anyway, you know, I think it was Ove that scored the goal against the US team, you know, and she's got a repertoire of what we call the maestro skills.
Yeah.
She uses our skills to great effect. They're not our skills, but we've refined them to where they're very effective, you know, with some, you know, extra sophistications, if you like, you know, and Mexico took it to Paraguay. Paraguay were lucky to lose 3-2. You know, in you know, because Mexico had a ton more possession, you know, a lot more dangerous attacks. You know,
I've never watched the Mexico women before, but do they play like the men? Are they quite technical and really focus on playing defeat and playing with some skill?
They really run the gambit. You know, there's some players that aren't that technical, but they're effective.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other players, you know, that play more of a passing game. But they're different from most international sides because they've got a few players that are very good in the one-on-one. And I'm not just talking about to create space. I'm talking about going at defenders and very aggressive going at defenders using moves. As you know, if anybody looks up the second goal against the USA, you know, you'll see that Ove, you know, uses a Rivellino, you know, followed by a scissors, you know, and completely sends the US defender out of the stadium for a cup of coffee, and then bends an absolutely beautiful ball from 25, 30 yards into the top corner, top far corner of the net. You know, it was a spectacular goal. As good as anything I saw in the whole World Cup, to be honest.
Yeah.
So better than anything I saw in the whole World Cup.
Interesting.
So hats off to, you know, the Mexicans right now. You know, but apparently she went to college in California.
Really? Where did she play?
I forget.
Okay.
You know, what's your name? Anyway, you want to hear this joke now?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So,
sure.
A country preacher had a teenage son, and it was time for the boy to consider choosing a profession. Like many his age, the boy didn't know what he wanted to do and wasn't concerned about it. One day while the boy was at school, his father decided to experiment. He went into the boy's room with four objects. Number one, a Bible. Number two, a silver dollar. Three, a bottle of whiskey. Four, a Playboy magazine. I'll just hide behind the door, he thought. When he comes home from school, I'll see which object he picks up. If it's the Bible, he's going to be a preacher like me, and what a blessing. If it's the dollar, he'll be a businessman, which would be okay. If he picks up the bottle, he's going to be a no-good drunken bum, and Lord, what a shame. Worst of all, if he picks up the magazine, he's going to be a skirt-chasing womanizer. The old man waited anxiously and soon heard footsteps as his son headed for his room. The boy spotted the objects on the table. With curiosity in his eye, he walked over to inspect them. His boy picked up the Bible first and put it under his arm. He dropped the silver dollar in his pocket. He took a big drink of whiskey and admired the magazine centerfold. Lord have mercy, the old preacher whispered. He's going to run for president.
Hey, this is topical for this time of the year.
It is, yeah. Things are heated up. I thought it was a good one.
It is a good one.
Speaking about things heating up, I got a couple of texts from listeners after they listened to the last episode, and they were both texts were smiling and laughing at the intensity and the heat that existed between Philippe and Andy about the discussion about Buck soccer. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah. Andy doesn't get the point that I love Buck soccer. He ignores all that. Because if you say one thing,
hey, everybody needs a foil. Everybody needs an enemy.
That he disagrees, he goes. But it's like nothing that you believe matters.
Don't insult my baby.
I didn't insult your baby. I said your other baby is more fun than one of your babies. I just compared your babies.
Let's go back down that rabbit hole.
Please don't.
Okay, but before we got horribly off track last episode, we were kind of digging in, looking at the Dream Team, right? The U.S. men's basketball Olympic team from 1992. And Philippe knows nothing about the USA. Were you born in 1992?
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually do know about the Dream Team.
What do you know?
Huh?
What do you know?
Well, it was the team that they put together with all the major NBA players.
Do you know any of the players that were on the team?
Michael Jordan.
Well done.
Scottie Pippen.
Yep.
the guy from Pistons. Forgot his name.
Isaiah Thomas?
Yes.
Wow. He knows more about NBA in the 90s than I would have thought.
Well, I like basketball. I watch other sports.
Oh, okay.
You know, I watch the documentary and all
1992
that.
Has a special place in my memory.
Were you in Barcelona?
No, that's the year I should have retired.
Why?
I've just been hanging around, you know, wasting my time ever since. Okay.
I thought maybe there was second piece of that.
But
joke.
I think calling it the dream team is a sin. You can't call a basketball team the dream team.
Because it's basketball?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dream team is the Brazil of 1970.
Well, you know, the
biggest sport in the world.
You know, I'm sorry to upset, you know, you Americans out there listening to this, but, you know, you invented sports just so you could be world champions.
Yep.
You know, and it's not really an international sport, is it?
You know? And you even call one of them
basketball
football.
Basketball is now. I think basketball's grown a ton.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, it's even so, there's lots of countries that
can't
don't
touch
really
soccer. Yeah, they can't touch soccer.
At least they invent the sport and become the best at it, right?
Who?
At least they invent the sport and become the best at it, right?
I see what he did there.
I mean, there's no argument against that one.
Look, I'm a U.S. citizen these days, so it doesn't hurt me when he says these things.
You're probably also a British
citizen. I flip back and forth depending on what's convenient.
What's convenient, yeah. Well, we dug into a few of the points, right? Some that we talked about is we talked about the value of the small target, right? From a contributing factor related to part of the success of the development of the Dream Team, like why they became so good. We talked a lot about the small practice area, and I think that's actually where we got sideways, specific to the conversation related to box soccer. But the next point that we didn't really get to was the high degree of individual offensive and defensive responsibility that exists within a basketball environment, particularly when kids are playing in the gym with their friends, right, or playing in the street or the driveway, where everybody's responsible for the most important part of the game when they're playing 1v1 or 2v2, right? It's basketball in the key. And so, Andy, when you talk about that specifically, I assume that the way in which you first started developing the 1v1 and the 2v2 training that I experienced as a kid, and we all three now use as a core piece, the only piece of really our training regimen, I assume you came up with that separate from basketball. But then in hindsight, looking back on it, you realized that our fields that we use for 1v1 and 2v2 were essentially the penalty box, right? Which would be a good connection or comparison to the key of a basketball court. Is that fair?
Yeah. In just about any arena where somebody is extremely successful, this is one of the interesting things about life, if you think about this. You know, pick out an arena where somebody is extremely successful in comparison to one of their peers. You know, and this can be cooking, can be being a chef. You know, and, you know, there are crucial areas in the kitchen that determine your success in chefery. You know, it's
chefery?
I'm not even sure that's a word.
But I'm here for it.
I would guess chefing, right?
Chefing.
I don't know where there's an R there.
And he's busy on Sunday evening chefing.
So, oh dear.
But I'm here for your analogy.
I'm going to be glad when these podcasts are over.
Never. Never.
Because I'll get away from the abuse. But in the kitchen, you know, there's key areas, you know, and you know, I was a kitchen porter in University College Oxford kitchens to make extra money as a teenager, you know, and, you know, there was three chefs and they had complete control and nobody else was allowed near, you know, all of the hot plates where the food was actually being cooked. The three chefs dominated that area, you know, and the rest of the guys, everybody else in the kitchen porters and everybody else around them, literally did their bidding as they wanted something. Go get me this. Go get me that. You know, and they were over what? As they were, you know, cooking up the meal. They were literally dancing on the hot plate. You know, they're flipping pans and, you know, and ingredients and getting us to, you know, make other stuff to put into the meals. And, you know, we are literally at their beck and call, you know, with ingredients, you know. Hey, dice me some carrots real quick. I need them in 45 seconds, you know. took me 45 seconds to get them out of storage.
And now we know why you only have 9 fingers.
I got scars all over my hands from working at a butcher shop as a kid, as well as working in kitchens. And character building, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, they were in charge of the goal mouth. They were in charge of the hot plate. They were in charge of saying what happened, you know, on the hot plate, what they wanted to see, you know, how it went down, how much they put in. They were the rulers of the hot plate, you know. And if you look at any sport like basketball, you know, it's the rulers of the key that are the best players. You know, in fact, though, with what Caitlin Clark is doing right now with the world record for points, in the women's game, it's even beyond the key now because, you know, Steph Curry, Caitlin Clark, they can score baskets from way outside the key, but the ball has to cross the key, you know, on the way to goal, and you can't goaltend. So, you know, once that shot is off, you know, it's a wing and a prayer for the defenders. But it's all geared, you know, from the basket outwards, you know, is where the action is. And that's the same in just about every sport. The key is to be absolutely brilliant, you know, where the heat is turned up. You know, whether it's pickleball or badminton or tennis, you know, when, you know, the tolerances are really fine at the point where the ball meets the racket, that's where you have to be brilliant, you know. And so that's the equivalent of the hot plate. And in soccer, you know, 99% of coaches focus on, in fact, they get out of the kitchen completely and they go onto the deck and it's freezing outside. they're literally, you know, doing possession soccer, you know, and, you know, they don't get into the key. They don't do micro soccer. They don't do goal mouth soccer. You know, they go into, you know, out of Siberia or out of Mongolia, you know, and, you know, they play ice soccer, you know, with a vast expanse of nothing and just an ice floe to play on, a huge ice floe, you know. And
well, I was at the game. I was at the field yesterday. It was yesterday for this specific story. And to put a point on your point, that I think traditionally we so often from a soccer perspective think of the things that aren't related to the penalty box in terms of from a training perspective. I was watching a U8 girls soccer game before my game with my U8 girls or U9 girls was to kick off. And the ball went out of bounds for a corner kick. And one of the girls went to go take the corner kick. And I mean, she couldn't have set the ball up further from the right spot than possible, right? So the coach walks down 20 feet to the corner kick and is like helping her set it up to show her where to do it. And the field marshal comes on a tear on his golf cart driving over there to abuse the coach. Like, oh, hey, you're not supposed to be anywhere near the field helping the kids. You shouldn't be down here by the corner kick. And I overheard the coach say, well, like, she doesn't know where it goes, so I was showing her because that's what I'm here to do as a coach, as teacher. And the guy was like, you should be working on that in practice.
Oh, my God.
If she doesn't know how to do it when it comes game time, you've not done your job as a coach. That's the direct quote. And I thought, oh, my golly gosh, what is wrong with this world?
That's like saying to everybody else in the, you know, who occupies this planet, the first thing you should be working on is your breathing every day. You know, something that, you know, is just so automatic. You know, it's a complete, you know, lack of prioritization. You know, something that is, you know, these people just don't understand that, you know, you don't work on your breathing. You work on the things at the edge of chaos that are going to make life.
Well, that was the point.
Hugely interesting.
That was the point that I wanted to make. If you're new to this podcast, which I think actually our listenership feels like it's moving up in terms of the communication I'm getting from people that have just found the podcast with new questions. If you're new to this podcast, I think it would be a fair, I'm curious if Andy and Philippe see this the same way I do, but I think it would be a fair way to boil it down to just simply say that from a coaching philosophy perspective, our perspective is that you should teach the game only in the box, right? Everything from a training perspective should be about the boxes, right? In terms of putting the ball in the back of the net or keeping somebody who's about to shoot from putting the ball in the back of the net. And because of transfer of training and economy of training, we don't have all the time to treat to teach every zone. I don't know how many zones there are or whatever, Philippe, on the field, right? We don't have time to teach every zone on the field, so we're just going to teach the most important attacking third, really not even attacking third, the box zones. That's what we work on. And those are so difficult that they naturally transition down. So if the kids learn how to put the ball in the back of the net from the box, then they're able to play a pass of 10 yards, you know, from center back to right back, you know, just on the edge of the defensive third with no pressure, right? Like it naturally happens. So don't teach it all, just teach the most difficult, challenging parts in the box.
So what are you going to say to me if I say I want to work on corner kicks and throw-ins?
I'm going to say, I don't believe you because I played for you my entire youth career. And once during the summer when it was really hot and we couldn't actually run, you were like, all right, guys, we're going to use this practice to work on corner kicks. And I, never again.
The throwing is the one that drives me crazier because it's almost like we hear all the time. Oh, when the kids are young and, you know, they go take the throw-in and they do it wrong and they raise their foot or whatever and the ref stops it. Some parents get so frustrated, like, why are we not working on this in practice? And it's like, sir, hold the ball, put 2 feet down, put the ball behind your head, throw it. Can you do that? Yes. Don't you think your kid is going to figure out?
I mean, if you can figure it out, fella,
like
trust me, your kid will get it
figured out. In 1 second, like, once you're mature enough mentally, like, you watch it and you say, hey, don't raise your foot. You learn, like, it's like...
What's more important, having the kids play and learn how to play the game, you know, especially in the clutch, you know, in front of goal, you know, or getting a throw-in right when they're 6 years of age or yeah, 8 years of age? It just doesn't make any sense.
Ada, you may or may not know this. After my college career, I tried out for I was living in Springfield teaching, and they started a PDL team there, and I'd played PDL through college, but I was like, you know what, I think I'm gonna try to play for another year just for fun during the summer. So I go to the tryout, and Chris Hanlon, I don't know if you know that name, but he was the guy that kind of ran the team. After the try, he goes, Andrew, I think we're going to have to find a spot for you. You've got a really, really good long throw-in. And I was like, all right, I don't think I'm interested anymore. But I am kind of proud of my long throw.
I saw the other day, I was in Florida, and I went to, you know, with a friend to see some practices and stuff. And I saw one of the teams in the club there, you know, all the girls, when the ball, they were scrimmaging. Every time the ball went out of bounds, the girls would do a flip throw. Like, all the girls knew how to do a flip throw on the team. So, like, it was the strategy. A ball goes out of bounds, they run,
yeah,
grab the ball.
Really,
but, like, all the girls on the team, ball goes out of bounds, they sprint, they do a flip throw long to the fast kid that is running. I'm like, is that what you're working on? Seriously?
But continuing on to the next point, Andy, you mentioned specifically very little wasted time. No chasing the ball due to a small game, gym walls, or playground fences, right? Like, the ball doesn't escape, so the kids get more shots, more repetitions. And that, I think, translates perfectly to the way in which we train, especially now, which is so much more efficient and effective than it was when I was a kid, when we didn't have, you know, year-round training inside a small indoor facility.
Yeah, and I'm the crazy guy that, you know, I've gone to the local futsal games, you know, because, you know, people probably don't know this, a lot of our listeners, but Kansas City is the home of futsal.
National futsal.
National futsal. And, you know, we've got really good local futsal. We don't play it in our club because, you know, we've got a much better alternative. And, you know, I went, before I put, turf in, I was looking at putting in a gym floor. You know, and, you know, so I went along and I took stats on everything, ball in and out of play, you know, gym floor, you know, and I'm looking at all the repercussions of putting in a gym floor versus turf, you know, and the simple truth is that, you know, in futsal, the ball goes in and out of play and there's a ton of wasted time, you know, and kids don't want to take on because if you fall on a hard floor, you know, it's incredibly painful. You know, and so, you know, and while I was doing one of my research sessions, I'm friends with the whole family, but, you know, the grandson of a guy that used to run a club in town called the Comets when I first came into town in 1985, Tim Knox was his name, and Roman, the grandson, was playing for the Sporting Kansas City Youth program at the time. You know, and he got tripped while he was dribbling and went down heavily on his shoulder and snapped his collarbone. You know, I can't remember the last time we had a collarbone injury in our facility. And the reason is we've got turf. Kids go down all the time in our facility, but when they hit the surface, the turf gives. And it gives just enough that you don't actually break something in your shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, once it, I guess I'm going to touch wood here, touch my head, because I don't want to curse somebody that, you know, next week is going to fall over and break their collarbone in our facility. But it's been years now, and I still haven't heard of one. Unless they sneaked off to the emergency room and didn't tell anybody, you know, then, you know, I don't know of anybody who's broken a collarbone in our facility. And, you know, the only time I went and researched futsal, you know, Roman broke his collarbone, you know, while I was actually doing a statistical assessment of futsal. And in every department, having walls, you know, having boards, the ball not going out of play, you know, everything being live, no matter whether it touches the nets above the boards or it touches the boards, you know, it means that you literally get like 30% more playing time, you know, in boarded indoor soccer, you know, just because we keep everything enclosed and the game doesn't stop for the whole time that the clock is running. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, and it's absolutely fantastic, you know, what happens in this environment. And 30%, people might say, well, on a game-by-game basis, that's not a lot. If you are literally losing 30% of your development, you know, that's half of the development. You know, 70% is left-right. 35%, you know, is half of 70. That's half of what's left that you're losing, you know, that 30%. You know, so you're losing a third of your development.
Well, for me, it's not just what you do. Maybe even more importantly than what you do in session in the sessions that you run, it's where you do it. And my example for that is I remember as a kid, Andy, playing 1v1s and 2v2s out on the outdoor field. And you tried to create the best possible environment you could, small environment for us, right? The two outdoor goals came. They were 20, 25 yards apart, probably a little bit closer than that, probably about 20 yards apart.
Yeah, I was the only coach in town that owned my own goals.
Yeah.
Because it was so important to have those two goals 25 yards apart.
Yeah, and you'd put them right up next to each other. And we train 1v1s and 2v2s. That's what we did. That's all we did once we got a little bit older.
And that's why your team was 5 times National Indoor Championship when there wasn't any futsal.
Yeah, there was no futsal then.
You know, the only game was the you
if
know,
you're
the
on
five
a cold
on
weather
five.
State, you were playing indoor during the during
yeah, 5v5. And all the best clubs played yep. intense, serious you know, indoor soccer, and entered the national championship.
Yep.
Back in those days.
But that environment, right? Like, I remember when we'd get tired because we'd play 4-minute rounds, right? And, you know, and we would go for nearly 2 hours of back to back to back, dog eat dog, 1v1, 2v2. We played in this small space so much that there was literally no grass on it. Not clumps. It was actually just like an infield of a baseball field. Like, it was just dirt. We get into the round, it'd be a cloud of dirt just covering the entire field for the entire time. And so when we'd get tired, I remember it well. Corey Farabi would do a Matthews and then hit it over the goal intentionally, and it'd roll 30 yards up against the woods. And that was a time for him to rest because I'd run and get it, and he would just rest and take it easy. And now in the indoor facility where we don't have that spare space, the walls and everything keep it to where the kids have nowhere to hide. If you give them an environment where kids can hide, naturally they will at times, right, when they get tired. And if you take that away, which is why the boxes are so great and the field is so great, that possibility disappears. Which brings me to my next point, a high emphasis on dribbling skill and deception at speed due to the small number of people that participated, right? So 1v1, 2v2, and 3v3. Those are the most common backyard basketball activities that you do, and those are also, they're 1v1 and 2v2 is the only soccer that we do in a training perspective. So Andy, share about that a little bit.
So the key to being brilliant in an offensive role in the outdoor game is in and around the penalty area, being able to dominate your opponent in the one-on-one, or even the one-on-two if there's two opponents. You know, the you know, pressuring defender, covering defender. You know, and you know, this is something that most coaches spend absolutely no time on. You know, they're so team-oriented, their teams are passing the ball around, you know, and, you know, kids graduate from our competitive programs in Kansas City without the ability to take a player on. You know, and it makes no sense. You know, if that made sense, Brazil would never have won a World Cup. You know, and Brazil, of course, is the most successful in the men's game, you know, winning World Cups, because they always had players, it seemed, that could go one-on-one, you know, beat a defender and score a great goal. And yet there are coaches that spend no time on fakes and moves, you know, no time on, you know, making every player on their team a deceptive dribbler, you know, and it makes less sense because the guys that can dribble and score are the ones that end up being the best of all on these teams, the world superstars, you know, the Johan Cruyffs, the Diego Maradonas, you know, the Leo Messi, you know, the stuff that he does with the ball, the guy's just magical. Even as he's getting older and slower, he's still magical. You know, and these are the ones that go the whole way. These are the ones that stand out. And these are the ones also that have the best attitude towards leadership. And these are the captains of their teams. Yeah. You know, because psychologically, they just believe they can do anything they want with the ball. So from a psychological as well as a game success perspective, you need these players. You know, and, you know, as try as hard as I might in the outdoor environment, and I remember the condition that I used to impose on you guys was, whoever won the race to the ball got possession. So, you know, you would shoot, you know, and let's say it was an equal race to the ball. You know, a lot of times then it was a 30-yard sprint to get to, you know, well, with you it was a 15-yard sprint because your shot was so weak. But, you know, it was a sprint to the ball, you know, to get to the ball to get possession again, if that makes sense. You know, and so there was really only a rest period when somebody gave up in the race to the ball. If the other player already had a 10-yard start, then there was no point in racing to the ball. But possession is 9/10 of the law in one-on-one. Mm-hmm. You know, it is in the game, but in one-on-one, it's even more crucial. So there were a lot of races to the ball to see, you know, who could get possession. Mm-hmm. You know, but now we don't even have long races to the ball because the ball hits the boards, you know, and it's right back into play. And so the amount of time spent between the goals as opposed to, you know, racing to the ball behind the goals and trying to beat your opponent and work it back between the goals, the amount of time now that we waste is zero. You know, where we used to waste time outdoors, as much as I tweaked it, we still waste time because we didn't have the walls, we didn't have the nets, and the ball got off of the, you know, the piece of real estate between the two goals.
Well, it's what you used to say back then, is that we got the most amount of development that happened for us in every calendar year was November through March, when we were inside renting space at All Americans upstairs practice field, which was the initial genesis for the size and look of our field. We've improved upon it, but that's what we were building off of, which takes us perfectly to your next point: an intense focus on shooting skills due to the constant proximity to the basket. That's how Michael Jordan, that's how all of those NBA players grew up playing in 1v1s and 2v2s around the key. And it's the same for us, but now that there's nets and now that there's boards, the ball is never in a place where it can't be shot, which puts all types of pressure on the person with the ball at their feet, because there's a moment to score in front of them. That's when the plate is the hottest. That's when the intensity is the greatest. That's when the pressure and the nerves are at an apex, right? In terms of a game. But then defensively, it's just the same. If you give them just a window of space, particularly if you're training with kids that do this all the time that can finish, if you give them a window of space, it's done. They've put the ball in the back of the net. So it puts all of this extra pressure defensively on our kids.
Yeah, and you know, I've had lots of coaches, conventional coaches over the years, you know, say, yeah, your guys are pretty, but you don't really know how to play, do you? You know, and you know, it makes me laugh, because all of my players became really, really good in the one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three defending situation, because that's all we did. You know, and what they meant by your team doesn't know how to play is tactically you've got no system. You know, and I agree with them with that. You know, tactically, we didn't have to have a system because we could destroy every team we played against, you know, by improvising, because we were so good in the one-on-one, two-on-two, and three-on-three. Nobody could read us, you know, because we hadn't gotten our players to play like robots. they all could make up their own mind, you know, pick the right option from the options available to them, and they could absolutely execute that option, you know, in incredible ways. Go at somebody, do a double scissors, blow by them, and you know, rip a rocket into the far corner of the net. You know, because, you know, that's what we did. You know, even when we were outdoors, the condition was you couldn't score, as you know, unless the ball hit the inside side netting. You know, and I would, you know, absolutely tie my zip ties to make sure that the net was tight so that you had access to that side netting. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent hours tying those nets.
Every practice.
To make sure that you had access to the side netting with a direct shot from anywhere on that field, because I wanted you going for that side netting so that you learned, you know, to hit that side netting again and again and again. You know, and it worked.
Yeah.
You know, we could thread a needle with the shots. You know, because, you know, the goal didn't count and they sit at the side netting. So we weren't asking them to score in the goal. What is the goal? It's a nebulous thing. You know, that's right where the goalie is. That's part of the goal, right?
Yep.
You know, we said no, only in the side netting. And it's like in our indoor facilities, we've taped off, you know, a couple of feet, 3 feet away from the post. And our players are told you can only score between the outside post and that other tape on the boards, which is the inside post. You know, there's still another, you know, 12 feet, you know, where the regular goal is, inside of the those taped off areas, you know, that they can't score in. They can't score in the regular goal. You know, that, so, you know, if anything, you know, people would be legitimately able to say, well, in that case, you don't try and nutmeg the goalie too often, do you? No, we don't, but our kids still can because they're so accurate. You know, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if that goal is coming out in a one-on-one and you've got no corner options, you just put it through his legs.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, there's a lot of transfer of training to things we don't actually work upon. You know, it's like, you know, our one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three skills, you know, transfers to retaining possession. You know, if, and I, you know, rarely if ever did this, but if ever we needed to, you know, kill 2 or 3 minutes at the end of a game because we were a goal up in a, you know, a regional championship game or whatever, my guys could literally play 3 minutes and the other team wouldn't get close to getting a sniff of the ball because they had the ability to fake to make a pass, you know, and to go in completely the opposite direction, you know, and leave the pressure in player 6, 7, 8 yards behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't just have to pass the ball. You know, so, you know, later on, you know, just that incredible ability. Imagine trying to mark, and you can see it, you know, right now with Inter Miami. You know, imagine trying to mark, you know, Suarez, Busquets, and Messi when they're playing keep away against you.
You can.
You can. It's like, you know, you know, the greatest team possibly Brazilians ever had, you know, in 2002, you know, Ronaldinho, the greatest Ronaldo ever, and Rivaldo. And you can't mark them. If they're playing keep away against you, forget it. You might as well just go take a nap on the sidelines.
Which would have made for some thrilling soccer. Well, the next point that you had, Andy, in this chapter, I want to bring Philippe into this conversation a little bit more. But it's lots of playing time, right? Games would last hours, and the best players would stay on the court the longest. So using that as our context, Philippe, I want you to, and we've done this before, but it's worth doing again, you know, visually imagine that court that you played on that I think was at the bottom of your building in Rio, right?
Well, it was several, like my friends, you know.
So what do they look like?
They look like exactly like our fields. They're small, tight, fenced in, you know, so the ball doesn't go anywhere, you know, doesn't have the same rebound surface, you know, from the fence compared to the boards, which obviously minimize the repetition. But difference is we would play for hours and hours and hours, like legit every weekend. But somebody would have a birthday party. The birthday party would be go to someone's building at 9. Parents would be on the pool, you know, just drinking and hanging out. Kids would be on the court playing king of the court, you know, just 2-on-2s, 3-on-3, 4-on-4s, whatever it was. Sometimes super crowded because everybody wanted to play,
yeah,
right? It was minimizing the time off. Usually wanted 3 teams, so to be more competitive. But it was all we played. You know, transition quick, one against the other. And, you know, like Brazil, so the skill matters as much or even more than goal. A goal, right?
But you said hours, right? Like it would last hours, like every
from
Saturday.
From 9 a.m. to 6 p.m.
That's what you guys did.
We would stop to eat, you know, and our parents were dragging us, like, you haven't eaten yet. Let's go eat, jump in the pool, drink some water. And then, okay, are we done? No, you guys got to, you know, let the food sink in and then go back play. And we would be like, crap. And then we'd go back, boom, play 4 more hours straight.
So the question I have is, if the field would have been a full-size 11v11 field, would you have played for hours, or would it have been too far, not enough goals, too much running, and you would have needed too many players to be able to put on
that? That's the perfect point, and I do have a great analogy for that. So that was like a little like neighborhood club that my parents got a membership, because that's where they would work out, you know, do all their exercise. And on the weekend, that's where they would hang out with the friends. Same thing, we would go to the futsal courts and play. And then when I was probably, we had a dirt field, 6v6, 7v7, like a bigger field that the adults would play on the weekends, like their Sunday league, right? But then the kids, after I was like 7, 8, they made that field onto a nice turf field. It was the first turf field I've ever seen. It's probably 7, 8 years old. And on the weekends, I would go to that field, but like sometimes it would have 3, 4 kids, 4, 5, 6. And like it was a farm, right? So we would play against one goalie in like a massive space, and it wasn't as fun. It was a lot of running, a lot of chasing balls, you know, running away from the goal to get the ball. And we would end up just going to the courts again. And it was 10 times more fun because it was tighter, more intense, touching the ball the whole time. You know, it's not that it's less running. It's a different type of running. Like, if you tell me, Philippe, run 2 miles on a treadmill, I have suicidal thoughts. I hate it. But if you put me on a small field running with a ball, competing,
you'll
doing
run 10 motion, miles.
I'll run 20 without even thinking
about it. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So. I mean, I think that's a really important piece to it. I remember I was in Mexico. It was about a year ago. My family and I went down to Merida, Mexico. I had a work thing, and then we stayed for an extra week, and we just rented an Airbnb house. And before we did it, I was asking some people down there, where should we stay? And they're like, oh, just pick a neighborhood. Every neighborhood has everything you need. And so you really don't even have to leave that neighborhood when you're there. And we're like, okay, that's interesting. Didn't really know what that meant. So we got a little house, and down the road was the corner market that we'd, you know, grab our snacks from. And a little bit further down the road was the grocery store where we'd go buy our food, right? And the other direction was the ice cream shop and a few restaurants where you'd grab your food and just sit outside, and that's where everybody seemed to eat dinner or have a late night snack every night. And then just down the road from that were the courts. And they had 2 courts side by side, both with like concrete stands. So it was kind of cool. And we've stayed here for 6 nights. It didn't take us very long to recognize that at about 8 p.m. every single night, those courts were full of people. Nobody was stuck in their house sitting around watching TV. Every kid in the neighborhood, every adult in the neighborhood ran down to the court. One court was kids. The other court was adults. And my family had the most fun for 6 nights in a row playing small-sided soccer every night for an hour or two. And it was just like the readiness and availability of that environment culturally was similar probably to growing up in the suburbs in a subdivision for me from a basketball perspective. Every kid has a basketball court, or a basketball goal in the driveway, so I'd find some friends and go shoot, and in that small space. And that's what's missing from a soccer perspective in our culture. And it's not going to happen tomorrow. We're not going to just go put up courts. What we've said before is there needs to be a soccer box facility, a facility like this in every neighborhood, which is what we're on the path to doing in Kansas City. We have 3 of them now.
Four
of them now that serve 4 different unique populations within Kansas City, where kids can get to that facility within, you know, 15-minute drive, 10-minute drive. You know, obviously we'd like it to be better, but that's what it is right now. And Quasi, one of the kids that play for Philippe, I got a call from his mom this weekend. Hey, the code must have changed to the facility. Quasi tried to go up there to kick the ball around and train a bit, and he couldn't get in, so I had to give him the new code. Players go up and hop into these facilities all the time. They have access to them so that they can benefit from them that that I didn't have as a kid, and kids across America certainly don't have.
And
well, Tyler Freeman, you know, who's playing professionally these days, same thing happened with his. With the Freemans, Brian and Tyler. Tyler left the club and he was actually with Sporting City Youth, you know. And I'd already found out through somebody else that, you know, Tyler and his dad were sneaking into one of the facilities that we had, you know. And anyway, this carried on and carried on, you know, because he wasn't playing for the club anymore. And eventually the code changed, you know, and I got a call from Brian. You know, and I said, Brian, I said, just, you know, so that you know, you don't have to feel bad about him playing for any other club, you know, is, you know, we want our ex-players to be as successful, you know, as they can be. So, you know, if ever there's a problem, let me know, you know, because, you know, we don't do the restrictive thing. You know, I used to work for an indoor soccer provider here in Kansas City. It's the reason I came to Kansas City. And the guy that owned the company said to me, there's a lot of kids that are getting onto the practice field, you know, in our facility. I need you to lock it.
I bet that went over like a turd in a punch bowl.
You know, but, you know, because we're not making money on, you know, for these kids. And, you know, and so, you know, when it's not, you know, being rented, it needs to be locked. And I just said, no.
Yeah.
So what do you mean, no? I said, well, you want me to work for you? It's no. I'm not doing it, and I'm not, you know, if kids want to get on that field, I'll unlock it for them, you know, because I don't believe that we should keep, you know, practice areas away from children, you know, that's just not, you know, and I know we're, you know, we're in this Sue Happy society, this litigious, crazy society, and I'm probably increasing the risks of a lawsuit. You know, but am I going to look at myself in the mirror every day and say, are you a good guy, if I've just denied a whole bunch of 6-year-olds and 8-year-olds the opportunity to get on our fields
and play?
Yeah,
it's good. It's good that you brought up Tyler, because I think that really does illustrate the point. Tyler is the youngest player ever to sign a first team professional contract with Sporting Kansas City. He did it at age 15. There are, of course, many contributing factors to that. But one of them that certainly is the case is the time that he spent in our facility on a probably nearly daily basis during a certain.
He's a dribbler goal scorer.
He's dribbler goal scorer. He's a give me the ball and I'm going to take it.
You don't get that from any other club.
In the back of the net. Yep.
You know, you don't, you know, you might get to be a centre back, you know, with another club, but you don't get dribbler goal scorer from any other club.
The last point before we wind down, and Philippe, I think you kind of said it yourself when you said king of the court, but keeping score, meaningful statistical goals. The dream team, those kids, the, you know, Americans playing basketball in the driveway, you know, whether they're playing 21 or king of the court, they're keeping score. And you got to win to stay on the court. Right, it's the same, I assume, for your king of the court and your birthday parties in Rio, Philippe. You gotta put the ball in the back of the net. You gotta win to stay on.
You have
on
no
the court.
Idea how it was recess in school. That was the worst, because it was the alarm rang. You had 30 minutes of recess. Nobody ate, so the little lunch shop there, that you always bankrupt, because all the boys, as soon as the alarm rang, were waiting for the teacher to be like, "Okay, go." We would sprint down the stairs. Running, because whoever got first would start playing right against the other, and then as the other kids came, first out, second out, third out, and you'd have like seven teams lined up to
play 30 minutes.
So you got into the first game. If you lose, you're done. So you play. If you give up, it was 2 goals, you're out, or 5 minutes, whoever is winning. If you're winning and you tie, you have the advantage, whatever. But if you gave up 2 goals in 1 minute, you played 1 minute the whole day. So it's like we were killing each other.
So some of the most intense pressure-packed environments that could have been was recess, because if you didn't win, you didn't stay on the field.
Yeah. Funnily enough, we had the same thing in England. Yeah. You know, we had a playground that was, you know, tarmac hard, you know, and, you know, brick walls around the playground, you know, and we ran out there to play every recess, every lunch hour. You know, we were out there playing the whole time, you know, and that was the best part of school for me.
Yeah.
Dude, the field that we played on was a bunch of the floor was like a bunch of marbles with like a big hole in between them, like squared, like they hurt like crazy. Like your knee would get in between the marbles. And then on the surrounding was like pillars, like big columns, like round pillars with a fence in between the pillars, like a metal fence in between the pillars. And one side had concrete benches with inside the fences by the pillars. So like it was the most dangerous environment. Like there were several injuries happened throughout my years of
character building.
But
character building.
We didn't care. We would kill each other there, you know, all the time. Hurt. I broke feet, my foot. I twisted my ankle. Like that doesn't happen here. It's a much more safer environment, but you know, that's what we had, and for us, it was what we wanted to do.
At the time, we didn't realize it, but, you know, we weren't allowed to use anything but a tennis ball to play. The teachers let us use a tennis ball because, you know, the big leather ball would break windows.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but it actually worked to our advantage. You know, just like in Ashington, England, you know, where I did all that research, that was one of the reasons why Bobby and Jack Charlton were, you know, centre back and number 10 in the England World Cup winning team of 1966 is, you know, in that street environment, all they used were hard rubber balls, small balls, or tennis balls. So these hard rubber balls were the size of a tennis ball, you know, and very explosive, you know, very bouncy, you know, and so, you know, they had to be super skillful. And there's no coincidence that Jack Charlton has the greatest number of first-class goals of any centre-back in world history. And he's a centre-back. And he's 6 foot three. He was 6 foot three. Bobby was 5'10", 5'9", 5'10". You know, and no coincidence that both of them were goal scorers. Is, you know, in the space they had available across the street from goal to goal, the first thing you did was shoot. You know, and the second thing you did was dribble. The last thing, you know, if you were desperate, you passed to somebody, you know. And that was it. It was a complete reprioritization of the game. But in front of goal, that's what you have to do, is you got to be thinking, shoot in, beat this guy, or create, you know, just enough room to get your shot off. You know, and the last option is any type of a penetrating pass. You know, and this is what coaches have got wrong, is they put the pass in. It's kind of the holy grail of soccer. No, it's not. You know, it's U.S. soccer. You know, shooting is number 5 on the list of skills in U.S. soccer. Number 5. Deceptive dribbling isn't on there. There's no moves in the U.S. soccer curriculum for deceptive dribbling.
I wonder why the players don't do any moves.
You know, if you develop a move, you know, which is the determinant of the greatest goals in world history and the Brazilian success, and, you know, just so much success that you can't argue with it anymore. You know, if you want to learn a move, you better not take, you know, get a U.S. qualified coach, you know, if you want to learn a move.
I mean, do you think anybody can beat Virgil van Dijk without throwing a move when you're going one-on-one with him?
Me, yeah.
Besides you.
Only because he had to turn around and play his own goal.
That's the thing they don't understand. You read there, taking one opponent's 1v1 as like what you need to be good, proficient as a winger for the U.S. soccer, whatever. So it's kind of there, but like take somebody on. What does that mean? Yeah, if you're really fast and you're playing U.S. soccer, you don't need a move. You can just run past people. You go play pro, you go play against a guy like Virgil van Dijk or like the professional center backs, you won't be able to just run past them because they're smart enough, they're good enough, that's why they're pros. You won't be able to beat them if you don't have a move or two, something that is deceptive enough to throw them off balance. So that's the point that coaches miss, is we need to teach them how to do it. We need to help them conquer something that will facilitate them in doing that. Not just say, just do it. Or the best one, go work at it at home. Go do your moves at home. No, yeah, go do it at home, but you got to do it in practice. You got to demand them in games. You got to demand from the players. Coaches have the perspective of, like, the individual development is each player on their own, you know, with their private trainer or, you know, at home in their basement, and I'll coach the team. No, you can coach the team while also coaching all the players individually and the technical side and demanding them for being creative. Now, takes a lot of patience, takes a lot of, you know, knowing that at times you're going to take more risk, you know, that can cause you a game, but it's you, soccer.
Yeah, yeah. Andy, Philippe, it was another good episode. Andy, preview us. What are we doing next week?
I've forgotten.
Andy's best jokes are always the jokes that he didn't prepare.
That's probably not a joke.
It's about curiosity. It's about the role of being inquisitive in educating kids, because we forget that. coaches become, you know, dictators. Mm. You know, do this, do that. You know, this is what we're going to do, guys. This, you know, and, you know, if with a whole different approach, you can get way more development. If you tweak a kid's curiosity, you know, and dribbling and shooting do. They're the two skills that...
More than anything,
kids are totally curious about, you know, where the bar is, you know, how good can they get, you know. But if you tweak a kid's curiosity, you know, and they're asking themselves questions all the time, how do I improve that shot? How do I improve that move? You know, because you've really done it the right way, you're home free.
Yeah.
You know.
Very good. On to the next one. See you guys.
See ya.
Bye.